This is Mobility Club, the podcast where we meet and talk transport. I'm Isabella.
And I am Santiago. Thanks to EIT Urban Mobility for making this episode possible.
Hi, Santi.
Hola, Isabella.
How many steps do you usually walk per day?
Oof, I don't count them. I cannot count so many.
Well, I think a lot of people think of walking as an exercise, but maybe not so much a mode of transport.
Well, it's a very efficient one, I think.
That's right. And today's guest can tell us all about it.
Our guest today is an expert in transport and land use interactions, travel behavior, pedestrian modeling, and equity in transportation policy. She holds the chair of regional planning at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. She has also been visiting a scholar in different European universities, notably here in Lisbon, with a Fulbright fellowship, and at the Technical University of Munich. We are very happy to have Kelly Clifton on our podcast today to talk about walking. Welcome to Mobility Club, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being on today's show. So sometimes for us transportation researchers, it can be a bit difficult to explain what we do. So when a family member or friend asks you, Kelly, what do you actually do on your day-to-day basis? What do you reply?
Write email. No, actually, my family has stopped asking me what I do. But yeah, I think I spend a lot of time thinking about what we do every day. So I'm turning that into a research problem. So how do we get around the city? What modes do we take? How do we feel about them? How do we feel when we're taking them? And how does the city itself influence our decision making?
And how was your path to come into mobility? Because you, if I'm right, you did not study civil engineering, which is a typical background for people, but you did mechanical engineering.
Yeah, I started out in mechanical engineering, and then I had a job at the U.S. Department of Energy. And my job was to work with optics, so not at all what I'm doing now. And I was spending every day in the lab and decided this was not for me. I moved to Arizona for personal reasons and was exploring what I could do for a graduate degree. Back then, the courses and the degree programs were in a printed catalog. And because I was doing optics work, I started with astronomy because Arizona has a very strong astronomy program. And because I was also reticent to give up science. So I was looking at the coursework and I'm like, this sounds like I'm going to be in a lab again. And it said, well, check out the courses that we have in planetary science. So I flipped to planetary science and that also didn't appeal to me. But alphabetically after planetary science was planning, not urban planning, not city planning, but just planning. So I was very excited about what I saw there and the mix of liberal arts, the humanities and sociology and engineering. So that's how I got into planning. And because I had an engineering degree, someone said you should go work for the transportation faculty member because she needs someone to do statistics. So that was sort of my path, very spontaneous.
We are very young researchers, so a lot of our colleagues deal with what we now call active mobility, walking, cycling. But that's actually a more recent phenomena, right? That we do have so much research on walking, on cycling, because historically transportation research has focused a lot on car traffic and transit. Hopefully, given that you've dealt with the topic of walking for some time now, why do you think that it's only a more recent development that there is more funding to do research on pedestrians?
I think mostly because of the concerns that came out of the public health disciplines. So transportation wasn't thinking about walking as a mode of transport or something that was deserving of big engineering projects. And so it was the health researchers that were saying that we really need to think about this. We need to think about safety. This is a real health epidemic that we're having, lack of physical activity. So it kind of recentered this around health rather than transport. And I think now it's reintegrated into mobility, but it had became elevated because of that.
So how well do you think that now transport and mobility researchers understand walking as a transport mode?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things is early in my career, walking and biking, active travel wasn't really considered by mobilities. But now I think that cycling research is eclipsing walking research, where previously it was the other way around. and was kind of at least within mobility is the domain of architects and urban designers. But I actually think we don't know very much about it. We still take it for granted because I think it's inherently human. Right? It's not considered to be a separate thing. We don't make a mode choice when we get out of bed. We don't make a mode choice as we're moving around our homes. And so I think we don't know very much about it as a mode of transportation, but I also think we know less about it in terms of how our bodies work. We as planners don't think about the mechanics of the body and the mechanics of the mind in terms of walking, or any mode for that matter. So there's so much more to explore.
Can you go a little bit more into detail what you mean by mechanics of mind or mechanics of the body when we're thinking about walking?
Yeah, sure. So in biology and neuroscience, they have a brain-body-environment triad framework for thinking about how living organisms have mobility and locomote. And we don't use it at all, but in transport, we don't think about the brain or body very much. So we have disembodied travel in our analysis. But the brain has to take in information from the environment and signal to our bodies to move. So there's kinesiology, kinetics of the body. And then as we move, we are constantly taking in information and feedback from the environment and having an experience. So that's what I mean.
Really cool. So you already mentioned the term experience, and maybe talking a bit about your own life. You have lived in quite a lot of different countries, different cities, and probably moved there as well as a pedestrian or also using other modes. And you kind of saw probably the influence of what we call the built environment. So kind of the space that we are situated in. How would you say has this experience informed your own research?
Interesting. I mean, I have been doing some like self-examination of all these places using Google Timeline. So looking at my own walking behavior when I'm in Lisbon, when I lived in Baltimore, when I lived in Portland, when I'm in Munich, and actually when I'm traveling on vacation. So obviously my purpose for being in those places are different, and my daily life and my needs and objectives are different. But thinking about how cities are configured and what gives me pleasure in walking, not just what enables walking, but why is it an interesting and compelling activity, is something that I think about more and more these days, about planning for joy, not just planning for the removal of barriers.
In the introduction, we mentioned that one of your fields of expertise is the interactions of transport and land use. What do we mean by this, and why is this actually an important issue to look at?
Yeah, so land use, really, I think the word we probably use more often is built environment. But basically, how does urban form, how does urban structure support or detract from our ability to get around and influence how we get around? So if we're in a place that's very sprawling, where destinations are far apart, it's hard to walk anywhere. So how can we think about how the environment supports our ability to take active modes like walking? And that's not just land use, like the kinds of destinations that we might go to, like the grocery store or our jobs, but it's also the built form, so, and the natural environment. So are there trees? Are there nature? Are the sidewalks accommodating? And then I guess another piece of it I've been thinking about more and more is the human environment. So it's not just that you have this structure of a city. It's also what are other people doing that makes it a lively and attractive place to walk.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Like myself, I've experienced it always when I travel to Southern Europe. It's such a different experience because people are just on the streets at night. And then it's just more fun to walk around, even if I don't have like a specific location in mind, just like strolling around, watching people and feeling a sense of community and being situated in a city. Maybe going back, I really like the point that you mentioned about planning for joy. Can you explain a little bit what makes walking joyful and how can we bring this paradigm into urban planning?
Yeah, so it's quite a movement, right? Planning for a positive experience, happy cities, I think, is another movement. So not just thinking about the utilitarian or basic needs of a person, but their mood and affect. I don't know exactly what brings joy to everyone, so that's why it's an area of research. But thinking about what gives my, you know, in my own lived experience, what gives me joy is like an interesting place to look at. There are other people, but also smells, noises. Like, it's the full experience that we often don't consider in urban planning.
Yeah, that's quite cool. Also, that there is somehow an aesthetic value, right? Because that's also something that engineers might not have in mind when planning.
Yeah, I think the idea, it's not just aesthetics, but, you know, as we ignore the embodied parts of travel, we're not thinking about these experiences, that it's just sort of set aside until we get to our destination. But we know from the negative end of things that it wouldn't be uncommon to talk about stress while we travel, things like road rage. So why can't we flip that over and say that we should be trying to increase people's happiness and satisfaction?
You mentioned earlier that cycling is now taking a bit the attention out of walking. We were discussing a few days ago that maybe micromobility is actually taking now the attention from walking and cycling.
Yeah.
How do you see this? Someone that you've been working for many years in active mobility, and you see that now this new trend?
Well, the older you get, the more you have to be okay with change. I think the instinct is to say, well, this is negative, it's taking away. Really, one of the biggest detractors from being able to walk is automobility. So if cycling and micromobility help us have less reliance on cars, I think that still can create more positive environments for walking.
But do you think that's actually the case, that micromobility is reducing car ownership? Or because, I mean, there's evidence from many studies that even there's no positive, at least in the case of e-scooter sharing, like there might not be even a positive netto effect in terms of environmental emissions because these vehicles are disposed quite fast.
Yeah, for sure. But that's sort of all things equal, right? We're not really making an effort to get rid of auto use. We're just adding this new mode, which is quite fun. So brings people joy. So I would imagine that the more you remove, you know, it's sort of like we're expecting too much, right? We're expecting this mode of walking or cycling or micromobility to shift people out of their cars, where we know that that's really probably not the right approach. But I do think if we have less car use, that we would see more micromobility use, for sure.
So for now, we've talked about walking mostly in a very positive way, right? Like, it has a lot of health benefits. You engage with your environment, you get to know people in your city and so on. But of course, there's also the side of people that are being forced to walk because they might not have other options available, right? And I feel like for other modes, we already have terms to talk about this. Like, for example, we have the term of transit captives or car dependents, which would describe people that are sort of bound to these modes. So maybe you can talk a bit from your own research when we have an equity lens on, are the benefits of walking or maybe also the risks of walking equally distributed?
Well, obviously not, right? So like any of our equity questions, we know that people have a difficult time getting around and many people have to walk long distances to access transit or to access goods. And while they might be having a health benefit, they might also be having a huge health risk. But in terms of terms for that with pedestrians, it's not clear. I also think that, you know, you think about as people age, their physical capabilities decline. So that's a different walking barrier or inequity than someone who has low income and is living in a place that's very far away from destinations mm-hmm. because rents are cheaper, or children who don't have autonomous mobility or who live in unsafe areas. So not only are they unequally distributed, they are heterogeneous.
Yeah, and like I've read a study was in a German context, but I found it quite interesting. It was how like about mobility strategies of low income individuals and how they also use walking to make transit less expensive. So in the specific example, it was about tariff zones and that individuals might just walk, so they begin and end their trip in the same tariff zone and mm-hmm. Pay a lower fare. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite interesting to see, like, which role walking plays also in a multimodal context, right?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that, but we see people do that with driving, right? Like, I call it park and hide, where you drive to transit and park your car in a neighborhood to save the fare. Yeah, so walking is more than just a singular mode. It's often our access and egress mode from all kinds of things, including driving, and also thinking about indoor environments too. So we don't talk very much about movement inside, it's all movement outside.
Do you think that here the difference is between Europe and the United States or Canada, general North America, allow us any generalization, or are there any similarities or differences in this aspect of walking and what Isabella mentioned about captive walkers? Because I think the form of the cities is totally different. Like normally, maybe in America, you have more the concept of suburbs, which are very different to the suburbs in Europe. And
yeah, for sure. I mean, the density of Europe and the leveraging of transit, I think, makes for, again, a very different urban form and land use interaction, as we were talking about earlier. And in North America, the car is the predominant mode. So they design out walking. And I find, like, when I'm in Munich, for example, and when I was doing pedestrian work there, and I was talking about the sidewalk network and, like, where are the gaps in the sidewalk network? And I remember my students saying, What do you mean? Where in the United States, you wouldn't have sidewalks in a lot of suburban areas or discontinuities in lots of places. But then in the other thing, the challenges, though, might be more similar between North America and Europe. Imposition of the car is still like a big threat for pedestrians. In contrast to the global south, you were talking about captive walkers, and we know that many people in Africa, it's easy to walk 10 kilometers a day or more. So in many ways, we have more similarities than differences when we're comparing across the globe, and maybe more similar instruments to remedy things than, say, other places in the world.
So we already talked a bit about underserved communities and the role that walking can play for them. You gave a keynote today that we could listen to, and you mentioned the potential of including the affected community in the research, defining the frame of the research question, or even gathering local knowledge. Can you share a bit about your experience? Have you done any studies like this?
I have done some studies when I was in Maryland of participatory mapping. So when I was there, I had developed a sidewalk audit instrument to be able to collect objective information about the characteristics of the sidewalk and the completeness of the network. And when we allow communities to do that instead of researchers, they're going to point out very different things. Their lens of where the difficult locations are very different than what I would see. So it was a way for them to give direct feedback to us about what the problems are. Which then made us think differently about how we would reframe our research question based on that new information. But I haven't done any deep participatory action research where I'm partnering with a neighborhood or a community for a long period of time, which is what I think it really takes in that kind of setting.
To make walking and active mobility attractive, we often need to provide infrastructure or at least a space for them to move. And this comes at the cost of removing maybe a space for cars in many cities, and particularly parking. And what we see in Europe, but also in North America, and I would say everywhere in the world, is that as soon as politicians discuss about removing some parking spots, there's a huge protest, both by residents in the area, but also by local businesses. Not that they say, hey, you know, my customers are coming by car. You work in Portland on a study in which you evaluated what's actually the difference on the spending of the walkers, on cyclists and car users, and how often they visit these local businesses. Can you give us a summary of the insights?
Yeah, so the study was a sort of a combined study where we were trying to understand the what's called a trip generation study. So how many people are coming and going from a site and in over a course of the day. While we were doing that, counting people and noticing what modes they took, we thought, well, why don't we intercept them and ask them as they're leaving the establishment how much they spent and how often they came. And so we did this at restaurants, a chain of convenience stores that were located around the city, and bars, and one other thing, restaurants, bars, grocery stores, convenience stores, so four different types of businesses. And basically what we saw was things that we expected, like a cyclist or a pedestrian spends less money at the grocery store on a singular trip than someone who comes by car. But then the thing that we noticed, which if you grocery shop as a pedestrian or a cyclist, you know, you have to go more often, right? And you go more often because you can carry less, and you might also go more often because you're walking because you live in a smaller apartment in the city center, so you can't buy as much. But at the end of the day, when you account for that frequency difference, the expenditures were not significant between cars and pedestrians and cyclists, with the exception of bars. And at bars, we saw that cyclists spent more. And so I call that the margarita effect. They have one more drink because they're not driving.
Well, you shouldn't drink and cycle.
I'm not passing judgment there. I'm just telling the news. I'm not in, I'm just telling you the news.
Did you try to communicate these results to these local businesses? Or how did they actually take them? Like, did they believe them? Did they mistrust them? They sort of, my experience doesn't match those.
Yeah. So for me, this was one of my best experiences in changing practice ever. So when we did this study, we had partnered with a local convenience store chain. And part of the reason is that we wanted to look at these differences in urban form and then what modes people were taking. So what was nice about a convenience store is they were all the same size and you just sort of imagine them being located in different parts of the region. And so they were very happy to let us do the study and stand outside their store. And so we told them in exchange for that, we would come and present the data at the end. And we're sitting in the room with the CEO of this company. We were presenting the expenditure data, the averages. And I heard him lean over to the chief financial officer and he said, these numbers are spot on. And so then we said, and this is how people are accessing your stores all across the region. When he learned that bicycling was a 30% mode share, he said, we're putting in bike parking everywhere. So that was a pretty amazing intervention that we didn't even expect. But the other thing that we learned was in places that have horrible walking environments, that sometimes they were 30 or 40% of the customers. And these are things that a lot of businesses don't know because people are just walking through the door. They think because they have a parking lot that everyone's arriving by car. So these are examples of people who walk by, because they don't have access to a grocery store, they have access to a convenience store. So the study was really rich in a number of different ways. So,
And really cool that it had such a tangible outcome in the end with the bicycle parking facilities.
Yeah, I didn't expect it, but it was like the first hint and probably why I emphasize so much the need to partner and to have these relationships with people as you're doing research. Because it would have been really sad to have that study sit on a shelf and now knowing that it could have had such a big impact.
So you already mentioned this power of partnering up with just maybe even partners outside of academia, right? So do you have other examples of like success stories when it went exceptionally well?
Yeah. I have a long-standing partnership with the city of Portland. So after living there and working at the university for so long, we developed trust. My graduate students go on to work in these places. So again, they are wanting to affect change. So one of the things that I've worked on for a long time with the city of Portland is changing their land development process and the fees that they use to make them more equitable and more mode agnostic. So when a developer comes in to build something new and they have fees to put in to account for the transportation impacts, they were mostly only thinking about cars. And so we worked with them to think about a method that would evaluate what the pedestrian impacts would be. And so we started that 10 years ago and or more, critiquing and then working with them to devise a new method. And even though I don't live there anymore, now they're asking me at the time of renewal, can you critique us and tell us what the next steps are? So, and then I've given presentations to city council and decision makers about why they should vote and in favor of the changes. So again, like a really positive impact, and I just feel lucky to have been able to do that, and so now I'm trying to do it everywhere that I go. Yeah.
Are new technologies making it easier to understand how people walk? Are there any negative aspects of it that you see? Like some people might be excluded of the data that we are collecting now, or?
Yeah, of course. So with all technologies, there's an equity question about who's using it and who are we reaching. So if we're dependent on cell phones and things like Fitbit and Strava have been really revolutionary in terms of being able to give us data about where and when people are walking and to give that back to people, right? People are now monitoring their own walking, which is, again, an amazing thing. But we know that not everybody has access. Not everybody uses these tools. And even when we do studies, like if we don't have a cell phone to give them, then these things have less utility. And so you have to think about that in studies. But I think the other thing about the technology is it's still not perfect, especially in very walkable places. You don't get the kind of routes that you would like to get from some of those data.
Because otherwise, what was a traditional way of doing this data collection before we had the smartphones and people had a sensor always in their pocket?
Okay, Grasshopper. Well, I'll tell you, back in the old days, we would either, pencil and paper, ask people like where they were walking and when. So that required them to either monitor it as they were going or remember it. And if we were lucky, also having maps showing the routes. So that's less frequent. The problem with that is short trips, people will forget the trips they make or forget sometimes the habitual trips that they make. So there's really a lot of undercounting of that information. And then in travel surveys, you can see it in the data in the United States in our national travel survey. When they started asking more questions about walking and asking more detailed questions, it looks like, Americans in like 1997 just really got on board with walking. But actually, it's just we changed the methodology.
I found it quite interesting. So you mentioned fitness trackers as a data source, and it made me wonder whether the fact that a lot of people now walk for health, right? We track the amount of steps we take a day, whether this can also be a lever on a more political level, because people care maybe more about walking, to put some of the research that we have on walking into practice.
Yeah, I think so. So back to like affecting change, I think politicians, and I've done some of this in the States, is lobbying our representatives, and they're much more interested in health as a frame than transportation. So they often don't believe that walking is going to replace driving trips, but walking in itself they believe is healthy and should be something. So it was a way to sort of across different political perspectives build momentum, where if you talked about it as a mode of transportation, then you immediately got tensions about who's doing this, is it worth spending the money, so on and so forth. Right. But health, everyone understands that walking is healthy, I think, for the most part. Whether they do it or not is another thing. But the downfall of that is where people walk for health reasons, particularly for just recreation trips, are not necessarily where they live and work and carry out their daily life. So if the policymakers are okay building a greenway or a greenbelt, that's a positive thing, but it doesn't change the ability to walk for utilitarian purposes and get at some of those equity questions you raised earlier.
Yeah, interesting. Should we move on to the last part?
Next stop, last mile.
We prepare some sentences for you to finish and some this or that questions. Let's just start.
Okay.
Walking is
fun.
I would love to do a study on pedestrians that investigates
happiness.
The ideal pedestrian pathway is
a sidewalk that leads to food.
Oh, very good. On your website, you mentioned that you like street art. The best street art is in
Lisbon.
We should check it out.
We have a few hours still.
My favorite thing to do on a walk is
listen to music.
One guiding principle that would make cities more walkable is
I think keeping an eye on fun.
Mm-hmm. The biggest mistake urban planners make is
there's a lot of them. I think solving yesterday's problem tomorrow, thinking like we're behind, so we're relying on old data. This is not an easy answer, but by the time we often have our solutions, there's a solution that it's outdated for the context of the future. So for a discipline that's future-oriented, we're not as innovative and groundbreaking as I think we could be.
Walking or hiking?
Walking.
Walking or running?
Walking.
Hilly city or flat city?
Hilly city.
Okay, so I guess we're in the right town today.
Yeah.
So this is more or less the last normal question, but still we want a relatively short answer. What do you think in 10 years from now will be the core transport related topic?
10 years from now, the core transportation related topic is energy. Mm-hmm.
So this podcast is called Mobility Club. What is your favorite club?
You're talking about a physical club?
It's totally open, up to you. You can understand any of the different meanings.
My favorite club is a music venue in Tucson, Arizona called Club Congress in one of my favorite hotels.
Very nice.
So before we close, our classic question for all participants in this podcast is, can you please recommend us one song that is somehow related to transportation? And it doesn't need to be discussing transportation, but maybe part of your personal experience with transport.
Well, a song that isn't directly related to transportation, but is one of the songs I think kind of represents the rhythm of the city is Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. So it has a great bass line and then a really complicated structure. And you just as you're walking in a city and you have all of this dynamics happening, it's a great, great song.
Perfect. Thanks for the recommendation. We will link the song in the show notes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
This is so fun. You did all your research. It's amazing.
We're PhD students.
This was an episode of Mobility Club, a Brum Brum production. Produced and audio engineered by Friederike Beck. Communication and marketing by Athanasia Karalaku.
Hosted by Isabella Waldorf and Santiago Álvarez Osorio. Music by David Waldorf. And art design by Lena Samuler.
Thanks for listening.